Senate will come to order. Reports from standing committees.
February 9, 2017, Mr. President, your committee number 8, to whom was referred House Bill 176 engrossed, Veterans Tuition Waiver Program Requirements, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Agar, Anderson, Baldwin, Christensen, and Meyer. Senator Meyer, Chairman.
Senator Hicks, do you have a re-referral motion?
Mr. Chairman, I do. I just don't know where it went.
House Bill 114.
There you go. Mr. President, I would re-refer House Bill 114 to Committee Number 6, TRW.
I think you asked me, and I get to
make
that
decision. Can I ask you to do that, Mr. President?
Without objection, House Bill 114 has been re-referred to Committee Number 6, Travel. Senator Case.
I have a re-referral, but I think we're supposed to refer to the bill by name at some point in the whole process. So the number and the name.
Senator Hicks, for the third time. Thank you, Senator Case.
Mr. President, could you go to Senator Case while I find that fine little piece? Here it is. Mr. President, I would like to re-refer House Bill 114 engrossed service and assistant animals by Representative Landon.
To where?
To Committee Number 6, TRW.
Thank you, Senator Hicks. Without objection, House Bill 114 has been re-referred to Committee Number 6.
Mr. President.
Senator Case.
Mr. President, I would ask for a referral to appropriations of House Bill 23, Secretary of State's Office Amendments, sponsored by your Joint Interim Corporations Committee. There's a $5,000 appropriation in there, Mr. President, and we'll see what they do with that.
House Bill 23?
Yes, sir.
Without objection, House Bill 23 has been re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Any other senators wish to get my attention? Mr. Majority Floor Leader, I believe we're ready to reconsider bills on general file.
Mr. President, with the outstanding job that the good senator from the northeastern part of the state did this morning, he's on a roll, and I think we just ought to keep riding that horse till he drops. So with that, I move that the Senate resolve itself back into Committee of the Whole for continued and further consideration of House bills on general file.
You heard the motion. All in favor of riding that horse signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carried. Senator Agar.
Yeah.
Whoa. They don't say anything like that to me. What's going on?
I have mine right here. Committee of the Whole will please come to order. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 113. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 113, engrossed, Medicaid Waiver Program Military Personnel, an act relating to the Medical Assistance and Services Act, sponsored by the Labor Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 10, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Baldwin, Boner, Bouchard, Peterson, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, I move from the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with a recommendation that House Bill Number 113 do pass. There was a standing committee amendment. I ask it be read in at this time.
House Bill 113, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engrossed copy, page 2, line 1.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment, and I yield to Senator Boner for an explanation of both the bill and the Standing Committee Amendment.
Senator Boner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, what you have before you today is a bill which is meant to help our active duty military families. The issue is that when you move from station to station, state to state, and you have a child who is a part of the Medicaid waiver program, specifically the Exceptional Family Member program, there's a waiting list associated with that program, usually about 18 months. And so what we found is that when these military families move from state to state, they automatically get put sort of to the back of the line when it comes to this waiver program. And this bill is meant to help out with that particular issue. But just by way of background, this is something that has been highlighted by the Department of Defense, and so far 28 states have established laws or similar policies which would allow these families to not have to go through this process every time they change their duty station. So just by way of a little bit more background, it's important to point out that TRICARE, which is the military's health program, does not always cover all these expenses. Sometimes they can be as high as $400 per day out of pocket. That's what this legislation attempts to get at, and there's a few ways that we do that. Just going through the bill here, really there's two different provisions. If you go on to page 2, line 15, First of all, what we try to do is, first of all, for active duty, but really any military member who is changing their duty station. But it allows them, in little I there on line 15, to basically put in and get in line, if you will, upon receiving orders to an active duty position here in the state of Wyoming. So that's the first provision of the bill there on page 2. And that's, you should just anecdotally, that's going to be, give them about 6 months from the time they officially receive that paperwork saying you're going to be moving to F.E. Warren Air Force Base in Cheyenne, and that's the installation we're talking about here, until the time they actually get here in Wyoming. So that will give them about a six-month head start. That's the first provision on page 2. Moving on to page 3, line 1, in the circumstance where that military member is separating or retiring from the military, we have the opportunity for them to go ahead and put in also to that to this process. And there's a few extra provisions that take up the rest of page 3 here. First of all, they have to certify that they're going to be in Wyoming within 18 months of separating from active duty. Second of all, subparagraph B, they have to have had Wyoming residency at least 2 years prior to entering the military. So these are Wyoming natives we're talking about, not folks who separate from the military from somewhere else and are looking to relocate to our great state. And they have to prove, they have to basically show their pay stub, their leave and earnings statement, that they do have a Wyoming residency. They have, in fact, claimed that with the military. And they have to actually... and once again, paragraph D says they have to arrive within 18 months. That's part of the deal. So that's the bill as it is, and that's where we really get into the amendment. If you want to flip to that, we'll talk about that. By and large, these are superficial changes. You see at the top, it basically deletes the first sentence on page 2, talking about working with a Center for Medicaid and Services. That's something that happens anyways. We don't need legislation that tells the Department of Health to do its job on a daily basis. But really, the meaning of the amendment, if you look on the amendment, page 1, line 26, it's going to add a third category, third circumstance in which these military service members would qualify. And that's if they were stationed here at Cheyenne and then they moved somewhere else. Say they moved to a state east of here or one of the numerous military installations throughout this country, then they moved back to Wyoming. They would not have to go once again to the back of the line for this waiver program. They'd have the opportunity to basically continue to receive the services that they've already qualified for when they were here in this state to begin with. And once again, we see the same similar qualifiers as you get there towards subparagraph A, B, and C, and that these are going to be Wyoming natives, folks who are in the state 2 years prior to military service, and once again claimed Wyoming as a residence in their paperwork, and they have 18 months to begin to move back to our state. So that's the amendment. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll certainly entertain any questions or comments on the amendment.
Are we ready for the question on the amendment? All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion to adopt Standing Committee number one, excuse me, Standing Committee Amendment number one to House Bill 113, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment has passed Committee of the Whole.
They certainly stand for any questions on the bill.
All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of Whole the Committee of the Whole rises, that it reports with a do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 113, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? House Bill 113 has passed Committee of the Whole. Senator Burns.
May I have privilege of the floor, please?
Absolutely.
Mr. Chairman, it is my privilege and my pleasure to introduce a good friend of mine. He was one of my classmates when we came in 1995, along with Senator Wasserberger, and he left. He, I guess, got some good sense and left after 16 years and went home, and he is now serving as a board member on the Natural Wildlife and Resource Committee. Please give a hand to Mike Massey.
The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 39. Reading clerk, please read the bill.
House Bill 39, Education Resident Tuition Reimbursement, an act relating to resident tuition reimbursement for K-12 public schools. Sponsored by the Education Committee, it was referred to Committee Number 4, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Coe, Ellis, Pappas, Rothfuss, and Wasserberger. Senator Pappas, acting chair, was re-referred to Committee Number 2, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Burns, Dockstader, Driscoll, Hastert, and Landon. Senator Burns, chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Coe?
Mr. Chairman, move when committee the whole rise and report it. Do so with due pass recommendation on House Bill 39, Education Resident Tuition Reimbursement. If you look in the title, you'll see exactly what the bill's all about. It's resident tuition reimbursement for K-12 public schools, modifying payment for resident students to attend school out of state as specified. This comes about from a problem up in my district, or a situation up in my district in Mammoth, where the kids in Mammoth go to school in Gardner, Montana, which is just a couple of miles away. If you'll look on the bottom, you'll see on line 16 on page 1, providing for the enrollment of a pupil in a school within a school district in another state. That's what it's all about. If you go through that paragraph, it's reimbursed from the foundation program. It's reimbursed to a district, and in this case up there in Mammoth, it's School District 1 and Powell is the managing district. As you get down to the new language, it's reimbursement and defines out-of-state reimbursement, but the real key to the bill is it makes it reimbursement happen on a current basis rather than be delayed. And this came about from our friends to the north that decided they wanted to get paid that same year when they have kids in their system. Moving over to page 3, you'll see again on line 11, current school year subject to the following. The report to DOE, Department of Education, pupils attending. You get to the bottom, it says from amounts appropriated on the bottom of page 3. Payments before May 15th of the current year have to be made. That's the absolute deadline. You'll see further on in the bill, normally within 60 days. You'll see in paragraph 3, little I on 4, the district shall not include a pupil attending a school within an out-of-state school district within its average daily membership. So School District 1 and Powell cannot count these kids. Bottom page 4, you'll see the state superintendent, Shell, goes on to some conforming language. On page 5, you'll see students attending in an out-of-state public school shall, upon the request of the district, be paid by the Wyoming Department of Education no later than 30 days after request for payment. We're talking about $1.1 million in this particular case. Our situation up in Mammoth and Gardner, I think, is about $600,000 of that. There's other places where this takes place. But there's no fiscal impact to speak of, and the real key to what it does, it makes this happen on a current basis. Current is the key word. Ask for your strong consideration of the bill.
Mr. President.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. How do we do that when we reimburse them? Do we take the number of students? Do we use REDM calculation of 17.5, or do we use theirs? How do they come up with that amount of money? We have to do it, and I understand that. I'm just wondering how you come up with the amount of money.
Senator Coe.
Now, this is an interesting question because Montana does not support their schools like we do, although they've made significant strides, and we're somewhere around 15,800. We use our ADM reimbursement that goes to Montana, my understanding.
Mr. President.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, why?
Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know, but I'll find out.
Good work.
Are we ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 39, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? House Bill 39 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 4. Reading clerk, please read the bill.
House Bill 4, engrossed. An act relating, NRC agreement state amendments, an act relating to the nuclear regulatory agreement and nuclear regulatory functions of the state developed under the agreement, sponsored by the Minerals Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 9, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Anderson, Coe, Perkins, Rothfuss, and Von Flatern, Senator Von Flatern, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Mr. Vice President?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a due pass on House Bill 4, NRC agreement, state amendments, and to explain that bill, I will call on myself.
Senator Von Flatern.
Okay, sit up. So, let's see. So what this does, fellow senators, is just comply with what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has asked of our state. This is part of the primacy that the state wants to eventually obtain. We're hoping in about a year and a half we will obtain this. Primacy over only milling of uranium products. And so when you go through the bill, it doesn't take into laboratories, medical, or anything else. This would be just for what they call, if I could find it in here, 2E11E.2 waste, which is that small quantities of thorium, et cetera. So what we go through here is we clean it up to match their request. We take out the word byproduct and put in byproduct as one word, which is grammatically correct, I guess, but also I would argue with that. And then we take 11E(2), and we put a dot in there because that is more correct to say 11E.2, and that's page 3. And then we write as amended because that section of the Energy Act of 1954 has been amended many times since 1954. So on line 16, page 3, we add the word as amended. And once again, byproduct in 11E2 as amended. We keep going down through there. Line 11, page 4, they have or concentration of uranium. We struck the word and put or thorium. And so onward we go. On line 16 and 17, we struck out as defined in 10 CFR Part 40.4 as amended to include. They asked that we strike that out. All these are requests of the NRC.
For clarity, we put in the exact citation of 1954 on line 9, page 5, 1954, 42 U.S.C., title 2021 as amended. Once again, that's been amended many times. And we, for clarity, we also on line 12 put in involved in uranium or thorium. And then you just went on with all the other corrections. And on line 16, we put the commission shall maintain regulatory authority over all other source material, section so forth, one paragraph, or parentheses one, parentheses three, and parentheses four, byproduct material. That clarifies that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission still has authority over those one, three, and four. We are only taking out the products listed under one, under two, which is waste products of nuclear, of uranium milling. So then on to page six. Once again, we just did some clarifications of involved in uranium or thorium and associated byproducts. Down further on 18, involved in uranium or thorium and the associated byproduct material of milling. We just added that for clarification. And then starting on page 6, line 22, the categories of materials governed by this article as agreed upon by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. This once again was asked of them, by them to us to install this. And then if you go to the next page, which is page 7, you go to line 7, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission shall retain regulatory authority over independent or commercial laboratory facilities. So that specifically says that the state will not regulate laboratories, facilities, which could be in a hospital, they could be independent labs. We have one of those in Gillette ourselves that would do some work with uranium or thorium, but we have no connection and no regulation as a state over them. Line 5 of page 8, we struck out reasonable rules. That was their request that we strike out. Is authorized to promulgate rules and strike out reasonable rules because nobody could really define what a reasonable rule was. Everybody has their opinion, no doubt. And onward, once again, it was all clarifications added by them. And then on line 22, page 8, the department shall also recognize license issued by other agreement states. And continuing on page 9, only for source material involved in uranium or thorium recovery or milling or the associated byproduct material. So that is what we're trying to gain primacy over. If another state has primacy over those products, we will recognize their authority as well, because we all go through the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to get that primacy. And the rest is all cleanup. Bottom page 9 struck criterion 9, I think. And on top of page 10 contains sufficient funds to, so it reads now, the arrangement shall cover the cost estimates and payments of the charge for decommissioning. This was something the House put in. They wanted to make sure that your bonding authority, that your, or you were capitalized to the point where you could afford to decommission and clean up the mill after you were done using it and or you shut it down for other reasons. And the NRC asked for what was on page 10, lines 10 and 11, where the director is authorized to suspend licenses, and they asked that we put in impound source material involved in uranium or thorium recovery or milling and the associated byproduct material. DQ, Land Quality Division, thought that would be a rare day that we would ever impound the source, but we wanted that in there. And this is all effective immediately upon completion of all acts necessary for this bill so we can gain primacy. Hopefully we do our stand-up of the whole department in October. They have 1 year for the NRC to say yes or no, and we're hoping by this time we come back next year. State of Wyoming has primacy over milling, and we will then charge, and they will, the industry will only deal with the state of Wyoming when they go for their permits and fees and inspections. It will be all done by us. We'll be gaining that kind of money, which now gets split between us, and then the industry also has to pay the federal government to do pretty much a duplication of what we do. So if we get primacy, we'll be the only person they have to deal with. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll stand for questions.
Are we ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Von Flatern's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 4, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? House Bill 4 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 2. Reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 2, Storage Tanks, an act relating to storage tanks, sponsored by the Minerals Committee, was referred to Committee Number 9, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Anderson, Coe, Perkins, Rothfuss, and Von Flatern. Senator Von Flatern, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Mr. Vice President?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a do pass on House Bill 2, and I ask that you call on Senator Rothfuss to explain the bill.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, it's Thursday afternoon, and I bring you a tale of lust. Leaking underground storage tanks, that's the most exciting part of the speech I'm going to give right now. Senators, House Bill 2 is about storage tanks. We have statutes in place that govern how to handle these storage tanks. And when we're talking about these types of underground storage tanks, we're quite specifically talking about your fuel and diesel tanks. This area statute is looking at our underground storage tank program. We get federal funds for that program. There's part of a management process through the Department of Environmental Quality where those funds are pooled through assessments out to the marketplace. The money comes in, and that provides a program to basically perform remediation, cleanup, and repair for failing underground storage tanks throughout the state. We have a very highly effective program. We have the highest compliance in the country through our program. These are some amendments that simply update statute and conform that statute to current practices. There aren't any significant policy changes, although there are a little bit of amendments to our procedure that's being codified in law towards the end of this bill. Walking through the bill on page 2, we're looking at what is effectively a new program, but it's our standard practice being codified, which has to do with the authority for the state training programs to comply with federal standards. This has been implemented since 2008, but this is being codified for us to move towards a primacy type agreement with the EPA. Same thing as we move on to page 3, looking at temporarily out-of-use storage tanks. This is a new provision, but standard practice where if an underground or above-ground storage tank has been temporarily out of use for more than 12 months, it shall be permanently closed in accordance with department rule unless a waiver is sought from the department with an extension. Moving on to page 4, we have some new definitions. Although these definitions were previously codified elsewhere, we'll see the repeal of those definitions a little bit later in the Act. On bottom of page 4, you see that we're changing department to mean the Department of Environmental Quality through its Solid and Hazardous Waste Division. That's actually where it's been managed since 2006. This is a case of statute trying to catch up with practice, 10 years out of date. Bottom of page 4, owner. There's a little bit of a refinement to owner, which is the D provision. It's being added to the current list of owner definitions such that in the case of a site contaminated by an above-ground or underground storage tank regulated under this article and where all tanks have been permanently closed, any person who owns a site. So we're talking about an owner who effectively owned one of these facilities before, but now it's been taken out of use, it's permanently closed, they still count as an owner, and that was not within the previous definition, but is still relevant for the program. Romanet 9 adds a little bit of refinement to things that underground storage tank does not include. As we move on to D, Romanet 3, it's really just a change of statutory reference where we're looking at pipeline facilities and gathering lines, and now we're looking at a federal definition as provided in 49 U.S.C. Chapter 601 and then further provisions of that chapter. Conforming language on N, conforming language on Romanet 10, moving down to the bottom of page 6, Rules and Regulations for the Council. This is the EQC, Environmental Quality Council we're talking about here. Page 6 on to page 7, you see that there's adding an additional proof for underground storage tanks that requires proof of financial assurance for above-ground storage tanks if the owner of the above-ground storage tank desires to be eligible for coverage under the financial responsibility account. In other words, whether it's covered under this program. The concept here is actually a concept for those individuals that actually have above-ground storage tanks, perhaps on their farm or ranch, that they don't want to be involved in this program. That's why it's explicitly written that way, that you can opt in, you can provide the financial assurance to, if you want to be engaged in this. If you just have your own system above ground, you don't have to be a part of this process, Mr. Chairman. Conforming language on page 7, moving on to page 8. Again, the financial assurance conforming language, bottom of page 8. We're looking at some new tank requirements and rulemaking authority. The concept here you'll see in the next three paragraphs is the standard best practice for tanks and for piping now is a double wall system with an interstitial space that is being monitored constantly. So it's an active monitoring process. You've got two walls. If any fluid flows between those two walls, you have an automatic shutoff system and you have an automatic detection system. You have to either repair or replace the tank before it can continue to be used. So this is basically implementing through statute what is considered to be best practices. All of the industry that testified and the trade association support it. It was relatively uncontentious, Mr. Chairman. On page 9, section 3, you see a couple of repealers that are just repealing definitions that are previously entered into Wyoming statute. Those are references to federal definitions. Act becomes effective July 1st, 2017. With that, I'd answer any questions or call for the vote.
Are we ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Von Fladeren's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 2, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? House Bill 2 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 237. Reading clerk, please read the bill.
House Bill 237, Community College Capital Construction, an act relating to community college facilities, sponsored by the Appropriations Committee, was referred to Committee Number 2, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Burns, Dockstetter, Driscoll, Hastert, and Landon, Senator Burns, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Burns?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 237. There are no standing committee amendments, and for a further discussion of the bill, I ask that you call on the good senator from Devil's Tower.
Senator Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a nice little bill that allows these community colleges have got prior appropriations. If you go to the back page, you'll see we've appropriated about $25 million. That's stop any questions for these projects that are already there. This allows these projects to go forward with private funds with whatever funding they have in place now. And the meat of the bill really is just that. It allows them to spend their private funds and move ahead with the projects. The rest of the bill merely shows what the projects are, and I won't go through those. They're numerous. With that, I'd stand for any questions.
Are we ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 237, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? House Bill 237 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 123. Reading clerk, please read the bill.
House Bill 123, engrossed. Probate, estates of non-residents, an act relating to probate, sponsored by Representative Greer, was referred to Committee Number 1, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Anselmi Dalton, Christensen, Hicks, Kinski, and Nethercott, Senator Christensen, Chair.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Christensen?
Mr. Chairman, let me get to the right number here. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 123, Probate Estates of Non-Residents, and to present this bill will be Senator Nethercutt.
My time. Mr. Chairman, thank you. Senators, you have before you House Bill 123. This bill has been amended from the House, and I'll go through that amendment here. So there is a standing committee amendment that we'll all be moving, but I'll explain the bill first as we do so. So the purpose of this bill and this amendment is really to update the statutory code as it relates to the probate of estates of non-residents. So in the event there's a non-resident who has property in this state, this is the process for how that actually gets probated. The amendment that the Standing Committee did actually added back in the language that you see removed there on page 1, lines 14 and 15. The basis for adding back in that amendment is there already is another statutory provision in the probate code for estates under $200,000. So it creates a superfluous piece to the legislation where there would be two sections of the probate code for non-resident estates dealing with estates under $200,000. So that's not the result that was intended. So that has been removed from this bill. So if you look at the Standing Committee amendment, that removal can be found on page 1, line 3, and then also on page 3, lines 10 and 11. We did leave in the language then found on page 2, which is really now essentially cleanup and clarifying language for the statute, which says in the event that you're filing a non-resident probate, that you should include the will if there is one, and also an inventory concerning the property located in Wyoming, and that can be found on lines 5, 6, and 7 on page 2. So we did leave that language in there, so that's really clarifying language, and that clarifying language can then be seen in the legislative intent language that we added to the amendment. So I'll let you read that. It's self-explanatory. It's somewhat lengthy, but I'll let you read that and stand for any questions. So at this time, I would move for...
Can we have the amendment read in, please?
Thank you.
House Bill 123, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engrossed copy, page 1, line 1.
I would now move Standing Committee Amendment 1 to House Bill 123. Ask for any questions.
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Why under Section 2 do we have to have a finding of fact of what we're intending to do instead of just let the law speak for itself?
Senator Nethercutt.
Mr. Chairman, so the courts take very seriously when the legislature adds language to a statute, and they know that the legislature doesn't do anything superfluously and without intention. And so the addition of this language of the will or of the Wyoming estate could create confusion. And so it's important to clarify for the courts that the addition of this language should not change any prior law. And so that's important for the courts to know as they move forward and as attorneys read this statutory code that this is really a clarifying piece. We're not altering the substance of the law and the intent. And so we've always wanted the testator or the will maker's intent to be the driving factor, and if there isn't one, that the laws of intestacy should apply.
Mr. President.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if that's what you're trying to do, why don't you put some facts in the law that talks about state specifics? You know, you read this, this says this act has always been intended, well, hello, to provide a simplified procedure for the administration. Well, everything we do is simplified. I just don't know why you need this.
Senator Nethercutt.
Mr. Chairman, can the President repeat that question? My chairman was giving me some tips.
Well,
Mr. President.
Mr. Chairman, that was the plan. I think Senator Perkins heard it. He'll answer.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the issue here... And since we're on the amendment, but I'm going to refer back to the body of the bill, The reason for the legislative finding, if you go to the middle, if you go to page 2, line 5 of the bill, and you see the word will, if any, the omission of this in the past, this is the confusion that's been caused by the, this has been a confusion that happened in a couple cases, it's happened in a few isolated cases out in the state. This doesn't happen frequently in Wyoming, but what you've got is that there's cases where it comes out and you have a will that's probated in another state. And so out of that state comes a will, comes an order. And the order generally is going to be specific to cover only the probate estate in the other state. So let's say you come to a state, I'll give you an example. If we go to the state just south of us, they have intestacy statutes and some other statutes, community property statutes, and some other things that are different than we are in Wyoming. So you have a person who passes away in Wyoming, or excuse me, and passes away in Colorado, is a resident of Colorado, but they have certain property that exists in Wyoming and has to be probated here. The probate court down there can come out and say, this goes according to the will as it's interpreted under Colorado statute. And so it would come out and may not be dealing with the Wyoming property per se. There may be a provision in the will that says, I'm leaving my property in Wyoming to my illegitimate child. And everything else in all the rest of the will goes to his legitimate children. And so the outcome is the order from Colorado that says, because only dealing with the Colorado property, says that all of the estate goes to the legitimate children, because that's what the will says. They're only concerned about the property in Colorado. Then it comes to Wyoming. Now comes, do you have an order from a court in the probate of the will in Colorado? It says all the property goes to the legitimate children. But the will says, which the will in Colorado didn't really anticipate because it didn't have any jurisdiction over the Wyoming property, the will says that Wyoming property goes to the illegitimate child who's a resident of Wyoming. If you don't have the will, then the confusion is, do you follow the order from the will that didn't deal with Wyoming property, or do you follow the order from the court that didn't deal with Wyoming property, or do you follow the will that deals with the Wyoming property? And that's the purpose of the bill, is to clarify that we're going to follow the intent of the person who made the will, the intent of the testator or the testatrix who made the will, and we're going to follow their intent and not rely upon another, because quite frankly, the Colorado court would never take into consideration that Wyoming property because it doesn't have any jurisdiction over it. So that's the point, is the belief is that this always intent has been, Wyoming has always been, and there's a long body of case law that what you do when you probate in Wyoming is you follow what the testator wanted. You do what they wished, and that we're not going to be bound by a rule from another court if somehow the interpretation down there would be different than the interpretation in Wyoming.
Senator Nethercott.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, really, it's for the illegitimate children. It's for the children.
Are we ready for the question on the amendment? Senator Anderson.
On the amendment, Mr. Chairman, I think I heard that this doesn't happen very often, but we're fixing our rules and laws to make sure we can handle it when it does. Is that correct?
Senator Nethercott.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. It's really just providing that clarification. So that section 2 really does state we're not altering the law. The courts have always historically followed the testator's intent. They are to continue to do that. This just provides that clarity in the event you have a non-resident probate of an estate, which does not happen that often, but it's not atypical either.
Are we ready for the question on the amendment? All those in favor of Senator Nethercott's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 123, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment has passed Committee of the Whole. Are we ready for the question on the bill? All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 123, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
House Bill 123 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 124. Reading clerk, please read the bill.
House Bill 124, engrossed, Uniform Trust Code Amendments, an act relating to the Uniform Trust Code, sponsored by Representative Greer, was referred to Committee Number 1, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Anselmi Dalton, Christensen, Hicks, Kinski, and Nethercott. Senator Christensen, Chair.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Christensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with favorable consideration on House Bill 124, Uniform Trust Code Amendments. And there is an amendment, if we could have it read in.
Reading clerk, please read the amendment.
House Bill 124, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engrossed copy, page 3, line 11.
Mr. Chairman, I'd ask that Senator Nethercott present the bill.
Senator Nethercott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senators, you have before you House Bill 124. This bill was brought before the committee based on work from the Wyoming Estate Planning Advisory Council, which is a group of lawyers who practices in this area of law. And so this is an update to the Uniform Trust Code as it relates to trust. There was an issue that estate planners and individuals who have trusts were facing in the event that upon the distribution of the trust proceeds, it may be prudent for a trustee of a trust to transfer those assets into another trust. And the law didn't allow for that ability to occur, for that option to occur. And so the purpose of this bill is to expand that to allow for a distribution of a trust to perhaps go to another trust if that's in the beneficiary's interest. So frequently you can see that in real application in the event an individual becomes incapacitated and the receipt of the proceeds of a trust may interfere with their ability to receive particular special benefits. And so a special needs trust would need to be created to ensure that they would receive the appropriate care and also continue to receive necessary benefits that they may be eligible for. So this allows for a trustee to transfer those assets into another trust. So when we look at that language found on the onus of the bill is found on page 2, lines 7 through 9. It identifies the language for interested persons, which just kind of creates clarifying language and defining terms for who an interested person is and the qualified beneficiary. As we move down to line 16, this is where that language really comes into play for how a trust proceeds can be distributed and allows for it to go into another trust. When we turn the page on page 3, lines 11 through 16, this is where the amendment is also found, and I'll move to have it admitted at this time, which is really just cleanup language, clarifying typographical errors. This allows that in the event a trustee is a beneficiary of a trust and they choose to also transfer their interest into another trust, they're allowed to do so. So it's really not that exciting. I'm going to do that now. So there's some... Everybody, thank you.
For the help.
I would move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 124.
Thank you, Senator Nethercott.
Question?
Question.
Question.
Aye.
All those in favor of Senator Nethercott's motion to adopt Standing Committee Number 1 to House Bill 124, please say aye.
Aye.
Oppose? Committee has passed. The amendment has passed Committee of the Whole. Senator Nethercott.
Stand for questions on the bill.
Question.
All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 124, please say aye.
Aye.
Oppose? House Bill 124 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 125. Yes, 125. Reading clerk, please read the bill. Oh. Senator Barner.
Senators, we're joined today by Jonathan Lang, Pastor Jonathan Lang, back here in the fishbowl. He's a partner that I work out with in the morning. He's the pastor of the Lutheran Church in Evanston and also in Kemmer. Would you please give him a warm welcome?
Senator Christensen.
Privilege of the floor, Mr. Chairman.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to also recognize former Representative Bob Rechtel, who served many years down here in the legislature. I see he's visiting us in the back.
All right, the next bill for our consideration is House Bill 125. Reading clerk, please read the bill.
House Bill 125, engrossed, sealing of trust documents, an act relating to the Uniform Trust Code, sponsored by Representative Greer, was referred to Committee Number 1, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Anselmi Dalton, Christensen, Hicks, Kinski, and Nethercott. Senator Christensen, Chair.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Christensen?
Mr. Chairman, I move that House Bill 125 and ask that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable consideration on House Bill 25.
125.
House Bill 125, Mr. Chairman, thank you. And to present that bill will be Senator Nethercott.
Senator Nethercott.
Back again, Mr. Chairman, back again. So this House Bill 125 simply allows for trust documents when they become necessary to be filed with the court for them to be sealed and kept confidential from the public. One of the benefits of creating a trust is that you get to avoid probate, and that means you don't have to file private confidential documents with the court in order to administer someone's estate. And so, but sometimes it becomes necessary for trust documents to be filed with the court. This simply allows for them to be sealed and kept confidential with the court. There's no opposition to this bill. All of the entities affected, financial institutions and the like, they all support this bill and understand the need to have financial information and the names and identities of particular heirs and beneficiaries of a trust to remain confidential. For that, I'd stand for questions and ask for your favorable recommendation.
Call for the question. All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 125. Please say aye.
Aye.
Oppose?
No.
House Bill 125 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next, and I believe final bill for our recommendation is House Bill Number 9. Reading clerk, please read the bill.
House Bill 9, Student Ownership and Privacy Rights, an act relating to public education, sponsored by the Education Committee, was referred to Committee Number 4, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Coe, Ellis, Pappas, and Rothfuss. No, Senator Wasserberger. Senator Pappas, acting chair.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Coe?
Mr. Chairman, move in committee the whole rise and report it. Do so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 9 to explain the bill. Senator Rothfuss.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I feel like I should defer to Senator Nethercott, but I don't know that she's read the bill. Mr. Chairman, House Bill 9 is the last product of the Digital Information Privacy Task Force, so you can all celebrate that privately. This legislation deals with our college and university students and their expectation of privacy with their written and electronic data at the universities and on campus and tries to draw some lines there for that expectation of privacy, which currently doesn't really exist. Mr. Chairman, right now, since the university technically has ownership and operations of their servers and the colleges have ownership and operations of their servers, then they interpret statute to require that they have basically full access to the information on it. And they've developed standards, and they're relatively rigorous on whether they can or can't access that information. But at the end of the day, there really aren't any statutory barriers that preclude them from looking at email and other information that would otherwise be assumed to be confidential. And there have been cases where investigations have taken place that don't require any type of warrant, don't require any type of search. But since they have the authority and ability to look through emails, when requests have been made from even administrative agencies such as the NCAA, they will look through emails, do searches, and they have an obligation to do that. So what this legislation does is clarify a couple of things. The first, you see on top of page 2, and I'll just point out to begin with, this is a parallel construct, so there's going to be statutory language that relates to the University of Wyoming, and then the second half of the bill will be identical language but for the colleges throughout the state. On page 2 at the top, paragraph A, talks about a key concept where ownership rights are not transferred simply because a material is placed on a server that is owned by the University of Wyoming. So you see there are no ownership rights to any electronic writing or other electronic communication created by a student shall be conveyed, transferred, or otherwise affected solely as a result of the writing or other communication being stored on the university device or network. The concept there is that the presence of it on those devices doesn't change the ownership status, doesn't change the intellectual property, doesn't change the copyright. It has no effect, which was the kind of key concept where it could be interpreted otherwise, depending on how the university was looking at materials on their network and on their drives. Bottom of page 2, or at least on paragraph B, begins the concept of a student expectation of privacy. So students at the university shall have an expectation of privacy in the electronic writings and other electronic communications created by the student, regardless of whether it's stored on an electronic device in whole or in part by the university. You see that there's some shall nots below, so that's a concept, but there are certainly exceptions to it. On page 18 on to 19, and then the Romanets that we see below, this shall not apply to writings or other communications that have been publicly disclosed in Romanet 1. And in Romanet 2, accessed by the university in cases where the university is basically maintaining the electronic devices or networks. In other words, they have access to the information for information technology purposes. And then bottom of page 3, paragraph C, indicates that these paragraphs A and B do not apply to a writing or other communication created by a student who is simultaneously employed by and enrolled at the university when that writing or communication is created by the person acting in an official capacity on behalf of the university. Bottom of page 4, or excuse me, top of page 4, paragraph D, provides a couple of legal preclusions. Nothing in this section shall be construed to impose liability on the university for anything that they're storing. And Romanet 2 required the university to establish or prohibit the destruction or retention of student writings and other communications. The concept there being if there was an ownership aspect, but the university needed to purge their accounts at some point and delete records, there would be nothing that would preclude them from having those data retention policies in place. Paragraph E on page 4 simply defines student as a person currently enrolled full-time or part-time at the university. Mr. Chairman, everything from this point forward, page 4, bottom, through the end of the statute is mirrored language for community colleges, so all of the same concepts, but in the appropriate place in statute to provide those types of limitations. Mr. Chairman, as far as the testimony we heard, the colleges were relatively favorable in terms of this statute. They feel that it provides some guidance and clarity. The university didn't find that there were any problems caused by this, but they didn't necessarily feel that it was necessary. However, I do have certainly anecdotal evidence from students that indicate that in the past, as an example, there was a circumstance where there was concerns about an athlete at the university potentially being involved in a cheating scandal, and in that instance, there was a request from the NCAA for further information. So not only did the university then, because they had access and the right to do so, search the student-athlete's account, but they actually searched the student's account because they could. They searched what they felt they needed to do the investigation. There was actually no forewarning, no informed consent, no information beforehand. They conducted it because they felt that they had full authority to, since they owned all of that data. There was nothing to preclude them from doing that search. This would provide some expectation of privacy that would potentially preclude that, and at least provide for some initial warning or information beforehand where the student would be involved, hopefully with his in place. Mr. Chairman, that's the legislation. I'd be happy to answer any questions, or if not, I'd call for the question.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, a couple of questions. I think I've got this down that ultimately if I'm looking at a couple of instances and just wondering if how this works. So if there's a grant or a research or someone's a research assistant or working on a project, I don't know if that necessarily makes them an employee of the university, but ultimately there's some IT, there's some intellectual property bouncing around in there of which these people are being paid to do. And I don't know quite how that works because I don't know that they're always employees of the university, but it could be wrong. The other one is to also with respect to papers or things that are written during internships or externships of students at the university, and so those types of reports. So they're not really employees of the university, but yet their papers may have a broader application, and they may have been employed by someone else while they're writing the paper, while they're an intern. Usually, externs don't necessarily have a lot of times don't get paid, but there's that issue. And then I guess the other one is what happens if because you're talking about in the bill that there's going to be to maintain a system, and so you've got something that's stored on a server, a student has something that's stored on a server that belongs to the university or community college, and in the ordinary course of maintenance they come across something that is a threat, would be obscene in violation of the law, such as child pornography, or that they come across plans in furtherance of a crime or a terroristic act or something like that. What happens there if they find those just in the ordinary course of maintaining the server?
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All good questions and certainly topics that were discussed and I think addressed through this legislation. With regard to the intellectual property developed by a student who's doing research, those students are either employees or they're under an employment-style contract. So in that instance, that information is actually generated by the university, and it's very explicitly governed how that gets done through the university regulations, same thing for the colleges, as well as federal regulations, federal law. There's a lot and robust literature behind that takes care of that to the majority floor leader and obviates that. And for the most part, although there certainly can be exceptions, student research is done with some type of payment in place, but you're usually acting on behalf of the principal investigator, the PI for the project, and in that circumstance, the intellectual property that's generated is the PI's intellectual property and not the student's, so it would fall under that property aspect, as well as when you read paragraph A, what it indicates is that there's no ownership rights conveyed for having it stored. So whoever is the rightful owner of the intellectual property continues to be the rightful owner of the intellectual property when this act is in place. And that's kind of the key concept. And in the instance described by the majority floor leader, the intellectual property is going to belong to the principal investigator and the university under various laws and rules. With regard to papers written during internships and externships, kind of the same concept. That property is owned by either the generator or if it's contracted, then the contracting agent is typically going to be the owner of that. If it is an internship or an externship, there may be a contract involved in the governance of that. I know typically when I work with intellectual property, there's always a contract in place. But even if there isn't, there's going to be some sort of rules that dictate how that intellectual property will be owned. And the paragraph A just indicates that ownership is not going to be transferred or affected in any way depending on where it's stored, which is really the concern that this is getting to. The three case, what happens if somebody stumbles along some type of information? The concept here is that the expectation of privacy is certainly not overriding any laws or statutes or all-encompassing. The concept is a simple expectation of privacy. There are certainly ways that can be overcome when you believe a crime has been committed. You can bring in the university police department. You can bring in the local police department. There are a lot of opportunities to get those types of things taken care of. And what I would say is that this more closely models what would be the terms and conditions of a standard internet service provider, where they don't necessarily have a responsibility to know what's on there, but if they find out something's on there, or if law enforcement makes a request, then they're going to participate. So with a standard service provider, you end up having an expectation of privacy in your relationship with them as part of your terms and conditions, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it can't be searched or it can't be accessed. It's just that you begin with that expectation of privacy, which is not the case right now. I believe that's all of the questions. I'd be happy to answer any more if there aren't any. Otherwise, I'd call for the question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, two questions. One's a follow-up to the last answer. I'm really not clear on the expectation of privacy. So if there was a crime being investigated, theft of intellectual property or something else, something more nefarious, terrorism or something like that, what would it take to be able for the university or law enforcement authorities to get a student's emails, get to a student's emails? Would it be a court order? Or their permission, or what's the standard there? The other question I have is, how many other states have laws, privacy laws, for students like this on university and community college servers that are being paid for by the taxpayers?
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Addressing the standard, certainly if there were any suspicion, a warrant would always make it at that point. So standard, if you need to search somebody's materials, if you need to search somebody's information, you get a court order, you get a warrant, and you're going to be fine. There's no heightened bar here. If anything, it's probably still a lower bar than there would be in other places because, again, you've got sort of terms and conditions as the expectation of privacy. But the expectation at that level with the expectation of privacy would require that a warrant take place, which would be the case right now if it were Laramie Police Department were asking or were needing to get into the information at the university, as an example, they would need a warrant. However, right now the administration at the university or even the UWPD could work through the administration to get access to the information because it's the university's information. This would make it to some degree the student's private information and have an expectation of privacy on behalf of the student, not just the university. With regard to how many other states have this, this is relatively new, and there have been court cases around the country, and it's unclear what level of protection. So there's a lot of low-level court decisions out there about this in other states, and it's a bit of a scatterplot as to how states or whether states have any policies in place about it. So this is one that's newer, and I can get the number. I don't have that right now. We actually looked at this about a year and a half ago, and I think the statutes have evolved since that point in time. I'll try and find out how many have addressed the specific data ownership aspect within their statutes. But as far as it being bought and paid for by the university or the colleges, the model has changed a little bit. This email is not sitting on servers at the University of Wyoming. For that matter, we don't actually pay anything for the email. A company on the West Coast provides all of our students at the University of Wyoming and many of our colleges, different companies, depending on which college we're talking about, free email. And the key is that it's the uwyo.edu extension that's owned by the university. That provides the university with full access and management rights, even though we're not paying anything. So while it used to certainly be true that there was a series of racks at the university where all of the email was. At this point in time, I don't think anybody at the university could probably tell you where the email was. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe some of them do know where it's at. But, Mr. Chairman, that's not how it works anymore. So it's in the cloud, and it's being provided because we purchase other packages. It's being provided as a free service by that provider.
Senator Burns.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that raises another question. If it's being stored somewhere in another state, then are we subject to their privacy laws? Or are the students subject to their privacy laws? Do we, in fact, have any can anything we do there actually have any effect on it?
Senator Rothfuss.
Mr. Chairman, yes, because what we're binding at this point really is the relationship between the student and the university and others in the university in their access to data that they have access to, effectively. So to the extent that you've got multiple entities that have access to this data, the provider has full access to this data, and they have policies in place, and they have an MOU with our university, and same thing with our colleges, so there's a relationship there where they agree not to look through it, not to search it, not to release it without warrant or anything else. So they have an agreement in place that's a contract, effectively. But at the end of the day, they could just look through it technologically if they chose to. They have that ability, but they don't have the authority. So that's governed by contract, and then our access to it is provided by contract, and what this law would do is effectively bind that authority of our universities and of our colleges as to what it takes for them to directly access the data or when they would feel comfortable accessing it. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple questions. On page 2, paragraph B is exactly opposite what we did in a previous life at a company. We made it that they should have no expectation of privacy in their writings or anything else on equipment that was paid for us and storage that was paid for by us. I would question that the university didn't pay for that, and it's free to the students, that storage. Somehow, the university has an agreement with the organization, and that's one of the freebies that they give the students for the university having some business with them. I don't know what that business is, but they are not just doing that for free. That might be a package that they've given to the university. But if the university dropped that package, they'd probably drop the free storage on the cloud. So I kind of question that university isn't paying for that also. Thank you.
Senator Nethercott.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I have a similar issue and question for the bringer of the bill, which is it appears to me that we're granting more privacy rights to students than the employees of the schools and or public employees in general. And so there, the distinction there, though, between who owns it really isn't the issue. It's you're granting a greater right to a certain class of individuals rather than what the data is and how it is owned.
Senator Wassenberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that is actually my question also. And I would ask the good professor that in his usage of emails at the university, he would have less rights than a student using the same university's email, and if that is indeed the case.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Absolutely. That is the case. That is intentional. That is not an accident. That is by design. Students pay to go to the university. I work as an employee of the university. When I'm using my account, I'm doing it as an employee on behalf of the university, and I'm getting paid to do it, and they are paying for that service and the information technology associated with it. Not only that, but I have in the university regulations, I have in the contracts I sign, I have an understanding and knowledge that I don't have an expectation of privacy in that email. When the students show up to the university, it's a different thing. Nobody's paying them to be there because they're not employees of the university. They're paying for the services. They pay a student fee for their information technology services, none of which really goes to their email, but theoretically it goes to a lot of the other things we're talking about. So we say the state's paying for that, but I assure you, all of them feel it because they pay some pretty hefty information technology fees to attend the university, and they don't get to show up unless they do that. So the idea that we can't give them email or that we're providing them a luxury from the state when they pay what they pay for the information technology, I think, is a bit of a stretch. And finally, it's unfortunate, but when they show up, they have no idea that they don't have an expectation of privacy that with that email, and we don't tell them as the university. One of the things we discussed is it would be great if we did tell them, if we made it very clear that they don't have an expectation of privacy, that every time they log in it says, this is not your email, don't write anything here you shouldn't write, and all of those other things. But we don't do that because we actually do quite the opposite, Mr. Chairman. We want them all to use their email. We need to interact with them, so we require that they use that email address. So, this is just speaking on behalf of the university, but I know that the colleges do similar things because they have their authentication systems, their interaction with their courseware. You use your email address to authenticate registration. So it is a tool that we require them to use, and so the university takes an active position not to discourage anyone to use that email address because we need them to use it. They pay the fees to operate it. It's reasonable, then, that we give them the same expectation of privacy that they would have in any other personal email account because they're not employees. So, Mr. Chairman, I would say it's by design that I do create two classes in this legislation, and that if we pass this, there's a different standard. We specifically note also that if you're acting as an employee of the university and you're a student, that in that capacity you are actually subject to the searchability. So you go back to what I have right now, which is not having that expectation of privacy in those emails. So, Mr. Chairman, what we do in that instance, incidentally, is we encourage different accounts. When you look at the ASUW students as an example, the ASUW president has their personal account, but when they're doing ASUW business, they're actually an employee of the university, so they have a separate account that is ASUW_president@uwyo.edu. That's the one they're supposed to use when they're operating business for the university, and then they're supposed to use their personal account to keep those separated. But right now, there really isn't much of a reason to keep them separate since there's no difference in what the standard would be between the two, where this does clearly create that delineation. I hope that clarifies.
Senator Wassenberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one last question. So, and I'm a huge believer in the date of high school graduation or the age of 18 or whatever it happens to be, that young person has Fourth Amendment rights, and they're guaranteed those Fourth Amendment rights as an adult. It's much different when they're a juvenile or younger. And so my question to the sponsor is, it seems to me we have a business, the University of Wyoming, essentially, and in all our businesses, in the emails we have here, we don't have Fourth Amendment protection because it's open to the public. But wouldn't it be better to require the university to tell every student you have no expectation of privacy? We ask that you get your own email address, and then you have your university address, rather than giving them Fourth Amendment protection in a business sense that could ultimately require lots of requests to law enforcement to get a search warrant from a court. And so wouldn't it just be better to say, you know what, university, tell the kids they need to have their own private email, and then they have Fourth Amendment protections with that.
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, you know, a funny thing is that our emails are actually protected. We have an exemption from the Public Records Act for legislative emails. Why did we do that, I wonder, Mr. Chairman? We must have thought there was a reason to do that. Mr. Chairman, the Fourth Amendment talks about secure in searches against your home, your property, and it specifically says papers. It does say that. Now, what are papers today? I think papers are in the ether now. They're emails. They're everything. And I wish they had the higher standard of scrutiny by the courts and with respect to warrants and how we treat that. Because that's what everything has evolved to. We've gone paperless. But the Fourth Amendment hasn't gone paperless. This kind of helps to strike a balance we think should be made, Mr. Chairman. We require these students to use these systems. We discourage them from having their own systems because they're not compatible when they send attachments and do everything. Students are, you know, they just deserve this protection. It's not that big a deal to try to get appropriate search warrant and due process because they just deserve it. And I don't understand why if you expect people to be good citizens, Mr. Chairman, respect the Constitution, respect the laws of the land, shouldn't we apply the Constitution and the laws of the land to them when they're in school? How can you expect people to grow up and be good citizens if we treat them like prisoners and take away their rights in the system of education? I think if we treat them with respect, we treat them the same as adults in this area, Mr. Chairman, we go a long ways towards improving things in America.
Are we ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 9, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
House Bill 9 has passed Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, let me turn you on here.
Oh, please. I'm back here, Mr. Chairman, deliberating with myself, and you know, we could do another 5 or 10 bills, or we could go back and rest up and get a little spit and vinegar on for our game tomorrow. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Good job. It's unanimous. I didn't hear any dissent.
Reading clerk, please read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. House Bill 3, engrossed, do pass. House Bill 7, engrossed, do pass. House Bill 24, engrossed, do pass. House Bill 13, do pass. House Bill 262, engrossed, do pass. House Bill 112, engrossed, do pass, amended. House Bill 113, engrossed, do pass, amended. House Bill 39, do pass. House Bill 4, engrossed, do pass. House Bill 2, do pass. House Bill 237, do pass. House Bill 123, engrossed, do pass, amended. House Bill 124, engrossed, do pass, amended. House Bill 125, engrossed, do pass. House Bill 9, do pass. Senator Agar, Chairman.
Senator Agar.
Mr. Chair. Mr. President, I move for adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You heard the motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Committee of the Whole report is adopted. Senator Anselmi Dalton.
Mr. President, may I have privilege?
You may.
I would like to recognize two of my members from our community, from the Wyoming Outdoor Council, Michelle Irwin and Janice Kanijan. If we could welcome them.
Welcome. Standing committee reports.
February
February 9, 2017. Mr. President, your committee number two, to whom was referred House Bill 55 engrossed, Spending Policy Amendments 2, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Burns, Dockstader, Driscoll, and Landon. Excused, Senator Hastert. Senator Burns, Chairman. Mr. President, your committee number 12, to whom was referred House Joint Resolution 8, Federal Responsibility for American Indian Health Care, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Bebout, Hastert, Perkins, Rothfuss, and Bonflatern. Senator Bebout, Chairman. Mr. President, your committee number 12, to whom was referred House Bill 35, Sponsorship of Legislation, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Bebout, Hastert, Perkins, Rothfuss, and Von Flatern. Senator Bebout, Chairman. Mr. President, your committee number 12, to whom was referred House Bill 36, Engrossed, Obsolete Laws, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Bebout, Hastert, Perkins, Rothfuss, and Von Flatern. Senator Bebout, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, I believe that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that the we stand adjourned until 9 a.m., Friday, February the 10th.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m., Journal Room S-27, House Bill 156, Involuntary Commitment, Emergency Detention Amendments.
Senator Coe.
Mr. President, your committee number 4, Education, meets tomorrow morning, 8 a.m., Journal Room S-19, to take up two bills. We'll continue our work on House Bill 40, Engrossed, Education Accountability. And time permitting, because we're coming in early, House Bill 139, School Finance, Court-Ordered Placement.
Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. President. Committee number 9, Minerals and Economic Development, will meet Friday, tomorrow, 15 minutes afternoon recess in Jonah Room S-18 to consider House Bill 220, Ad Valorem Taxation Liens on Mineral Production. That's continued from a couple days ago. House Bill 254, Public Purpose Investments, and if we have time, House Bill 253, Engrossed Economic Development Account Funding, and House Bill 183, Engrossed Security for On-Deposit Public Funds.
Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Wise President. Your Judiciary Committee number 1 will meet tomorrow at 8 o'clock House Bill to look at House Bills 88, Background Checks, Enterprise Technology Services, House Bill 90, Concealed Weapons, Military Family Applicants, House Bill 231, Engrossed Firearm Possession, to allow felons antique firearms, and we'll do that at 8 o'clock.
Senator Burns.
Mr. President, just to remind everybody, you have till 5 p.m. tonight to get in your third reading amendments on the budget.
Any other announcements? You've heard the motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Senate is adjourned until 9 a.m. tomorrow, Friday, February the 9th.